welcome to Sex And, the podcast that talks about how our mental and physical health affects how we love and how we make love. Or fuck, because it's not always about love, is it? I am Megan Narvaez, a licensed mental health counselor turned sex and relationship wellness coach. The goal of this podcast is to bring more attention to pleasure and how to connect back to one's sexual expression during times of health challenges. Because let's be real here, our desire for sex, connection, and communication with our partners just don't disappear when we're going through hardship. Instead, they usually become additional problems to add to our stress. And before we get to today's episode, I want to say that if you are a minor, please check in with your grown person before listening in. Ask if it's okay, and have a conversation about why or why not either way. This podcast is also not a substitute for therapy. The stories and experiences of guests on the show are theirs and personal. Some of their stories may resonate with you, other parts may be different, and that's okay. As a quick update, I am now in Georgia. So I started from Taiwan. I left Taiwan March 2nd. Took, what was it, like a 12-hour plane ride to LA. Spent 8 days in LA, and now I am at my partner's parents' house where I will be living, calling it my home base, something like that, for maybe about 8 months. The plan is that I go to Japan, and I don't know if that's going to happen because of the coronavirus stuff. Oh, man. I am trying not to be super freaked out about the coronavirus. When it first happened, I definitely acknowledged I didn't see it as a big deal. I didn't understand the gravity of it, because we didn't have a lot of information about how grave the situation is. But now I'm here in America again, where it seems like everyone just fucking has coronavirus. Who knows? Because, of course, we don't have the ability to test everyone to see who and who doesn't have it. But ironically, my people around me, mostly my family, encouraged me to leave Taiwan, leave Southeast Asia as soon as I can, and come to America so we can be safe at home. And even then, when they were pushing and encouraging for that, I knew that it was, I understood their worries and their want for us to come back to America as misguided, because from the beginning I felt so safe in Taiwan. I could see how Taiwan was putting in every measure to keep Taiwan safe from people coming in from other countries with the virus. I could see how they're putting measures in place to make sure that it didn't spread from those who did have it. And I had health insurance. Well, it just seemed like a better idea to stay there. There are a lot of reasons why Taiwan is doing so well with controlling and containing the virus, something that hopefully the other parts of the world can learn from. But yeah, like I was saying, our families wanted us to come here, and ironically now, like in America, it's just so much worse. I'm so much more at risk of getting the coronavirus here living in Atlanta, Georgia, than I was living in the mountains of Taiwan, or anywhere in Taiwan for that matter. So, you know, as it goes. But anyway, to say then that I hope everyone is doing their best to take care of themselves, not just in social distancing and washing your hands and not touching your face, which are all really important things, but also in self-care and anxiety reduction and finding healthy coping mechanisms. I noticed myself spending a lot of time on the internet, just like reading every article about the coronavirus to see what's going on in different places. I don't usually use Twitter, but Twitter is a very fun place to spiral. It's like 1 a.m. when you should be asleep, just seeing other people's comments about what's going on. And it's not even news, right? It's just like what other people are saying. It's just something to scroll and, like, I guess get a dopamine release. That's pretty much what's happening with all the scrolling I'm doing. But I notice it's very unhealthy and unfulfilling, and I really want to cut back on it. I'm sure other people feel the same way, just devouring all this news about the coronavirus, about the Trump administration, about Italy, China, maybe other countries that are very close to home for you, that maybe have family or friends in, and you want to know what's going on, and just consuming. And, oh, man, I'm getting exhausted just being on the internet all the time, yet it's really hard for me to turn away. So encouraging everyone who is listening to find ways to unplug, take a deep breath, wash your hands, and read a book, or sew, or knit, or draw, or work on the business of your dreams that you always want to work on. I realistically should be working on my self-employment hustle plans, but the combination of just moving back to America, settling into a new environment, reconnecting with family and friends, and then also this like sense of doom that all of that is just keeping me from the motivation to work on my business. But realistically, the perfect time, because I am not even in isolation, I'm just unemployed right now. So, you know, everyone try to put motivational energy my way. But anyway, so today's episode, we are talking to Jillian Lawrence. I met Jillian at a place called Arts and Craft, where her art and poetry were being presented, and I had a chance to talk to her about her art and look at it and get to know her a little bit more while we were meeting up in person. And Arts and Craft is actually a Black-owned bar in Taichung, Taiwan. And from what I remember them saying, they are the only Black-owned business in Taiwan. So if you do live in Taiwan, if you do live in Taichung or have the chance to visit, definitely go to Arts and Crafts, because the space is amazing. It's not only a bar, but it's also very art-focused. It's very community-focused, and it has just really great vibes. And they have a Taiwan dog that sometimes hangs out, so, you know, go for the pets as well. So Julie and I had a chance to meet in person, and then when I did the podcast, she was really excited to share her story. And so in her story, you're going to hear more about her experiences with mental health issues, including borderline personality disorder and having disordered eating. So to anyone who might find this story uncomfortable, as I've said before in other podcasts, please take care of yourself while listening. There might be some things that you listen to that might be re-traumatizing or triggering or just brings up some anxiety from your past or present. And so you are free, absolutely, to pause, take a break, stop the podcast altogether, and just care for yourself in whatever ways that are helpful while listening. Topics that may be uncomfortable include self-harm, disordered eating, homophobia, and borderline personality disorder. Speaking of being self-employed / unemployed, if you would like to show this episode, if you would like to show Sex and your financial support, that would be very much appreciated. At the bottom of the show notes, you will see a link that will send you to a place where you can donate to me and Sex and. I do this show on my own time. I don't get paid for it. I don't have sponsorships yet. So any love that you can show would be very appreciated. So again, just take care of yourself and enjoy the show. Well, hello. We are here with Jillian Lawrence, and I am super excited to be talking to you. Can you introduce yourself to people who don't know you?
Okay. My name is Jillian. I live in Taichung, Taiwan. I've been here for, every time I say this, the time gets longer and I'm like, oh, I've been here for almost 4 years. Yeah, so I've been here for 4 years teaching and then also like doing my own stuff on the side, like my writing and my art. I'm from South Africa, Cape Town, South Africa.
And what brought you to Taiwan?
Oh, I just graduated and I was just looking for like a gap year opportunity. Like I was intending on teaching for a year, maybe 2 years. And then Taiwan was the place where all of my documents and everything, the application process went the smoothest and the fastest. So that I ended up coming here. I didn't know much about Taiwan before actually moving here. And then got placed in Taichung at the place where I'm currently teaching. So it was kind of by chance, and then I fell in love with where I was placed.
So to talk about your reason for deciding to be on the podcast, because when I advertised it, I think pretty quickly you sent me a story submission for the podcast, which I really appreciated. And so I was really excited to get your submission and to hear more about your story. So what made you decide to be on the podcast?
Firstly, I really like the premise for your podcast. I like the idea of talking about, first, the biggest thing for me was like mental health. I really liked that you wanted to incorporate that, especially with when it comes to sex and sexual health, sexual identity. Those are all things that kind of like really stand out to me as like talking points and things that I feel like we should be talking more openly about. And when I saw it, I was just like, yes, it's still a sensitive topic for me. And it's not going to be something that I find, like, even when I was doing my story submission, I was like, I really be telling this person that I don't really know, like all these things. And I'm like, yeah, actually, it might help someone, or like, you know, make someone feel like, oh, I'm not alone necessarily, or this isn't a strange thing to feel. Because I know that a lot of my personal struggles or kind of like my problems were so unique, but usually that's not the case. Usually there are people with experiences that, you know, you can take what, that's why it's so important to have open conversations. Like you find similarities in other people's stories and you learn that you're not alone.
Thank you. Because all of what you said is exactly why I wanted to do this podcast. I think it's really vulnerable and really scary to share our stories, but I mean, I love podcasts and I love learning about other people's stories myself. And I think it's really important to give people space to talk about it, one for their own healing process and one to like reclaim their story and identities, but then also to give other people that power too, because we can feel really alone, especially when we don't talk about it, talk about mental health issues or sexual health challenges. And having someone with a similar story especially helps people to see like, oh wow, this person went through it and they've found ways that work for them to make it through, and I can do that too. And maybe I can pull from their ways of doing it, get examples from them, see what works, see what doesn't for me, and be able to move forward in that way. So shining lights onto challenges is a great way, a beautiful way to help people find their power.
Yeah.
So about your story, you've mentioned that you've dealt with mental health issues since early teenage years when you were telling me about yourself in the pre-question. So can you tell us what kind of mental health challenges did you have as a teenager?
So that was like probably the earliest kind of memory I have of it as being something significant. It was probably around 14 or 15. And I've struggled a lot with like mostly depression and anxiety, more strongly depression. There's a actual term for it, but it's like basically like high functioning depression. That was like the catalyst for my mental health experience of something not being 100% okay. And then in university, that kind of evolved as I kind of learned more about myself. I studied psychology, and as I learned more about like technical terms and like different disorders and that kind of thing, I found out about something called borderline personality disorder, which is like bipolar, but the episodes are shorter, like the waves are shorter. So instead of having like a manic period for like a couple of months and then a depressive episode for a couple of months, I would go through these these cycles, anything within like a day or like a week. You would think of like severe mood swings. It's kind of like that.
So this is something they experienced when you were a teenager, but maybe you didn't have the words for at the time.
It's like, for example, the manic episodes that just manifested in me kind of being happy or like very productive and like very creatively charged, perhaps a little bit more impulsive, but because nothing typically negative came from that, even though, like, for example, I can see now that, like, in manic episodes, my productivity was higher, but I wasn't sleeping or things like that. But I never viewed those as being negative things. So I never considered that that was also part of my mental health, like instability. I just focused on, like, oh, I'm having a depressive episode, so I must have depression. Because right. depression and anxiety have a bigger spotlight in terms of, like, mental health awareness and information. So that those are the first things that people kind of, like, recognize, I suppose.
Yeah, when we're feeling productive and just getting all these things done, we don't look too closely at if it's like a effect of something else. We're just like, yeah, we're doing something awesome and we're getting shit done. And it's only when we're having a harder time, feeling like we're in a darker place, do we actually pay attention to what's going on and question things. I can see how it was harder to identify it and not really noticing that there's a pattern there. Yeah. So what kinds of things were you experiencing as a teenager in terms of your sexual, not sexual identity? I use the word sexual identity and people confuse that with like heterosexual or bisexual kinds of things, but more of just as you're coming into your sexual being as a teenager, how are those things affecting you?
Yeah. Repressed is the first word that comes to mind, but it's not that intense, really. My family, especially when we were younger, very conservative Christian, so like sex was something that was communicated as, you know, only for marriage, only between a man and a woman. It was also something that they never spoke to us about openly. It's quite frustrating now because especially like my dad, like he will talk about sex and he has no problems talking about sex in front of us or to us, like in my high school years specifically. And not necessarily like the content of the conversations we're having, just like the openness around sex in general.
So it's nice to have it now, but being a teenager, you really could have benefited from then.
Yeah. So there weren't a lot of open conversations. It was definitely treated with this sense of like taboo kind of thing, or it's just like, oh no, you're a child, you're not supposed to know about these things yet, or like, you know, like that kind of attitude. And then also just I identify as bisexual or queer, and at the time, like high school, this is why I say repressed, I was kind of actively shoving that part of myself. I was like in a heavy state of denial in terms of like my attraction towards women, my feelings for women.
What was the risk for you to acknowledge it?
Just what my family would think and not wanting to disappoint them, knowing, not even disappointing them, just my mother's sister is openly gay and she has a partner. And like they were a part of my life for, you know, like all of my life. So just from my personal experience of seeing how my family dealt with her sexuality, I internalized in terms of like how I thought that they would react to me coming out to them. So like I heard them express things about her and about her sexuality that kind of like scarred me a little bit. It's just like, oh, you view this very negatively. And it was definitely very much linked to my family's religious convictions, because I knew that they were not saying those things to her face as well. So it was just like, I don't want to have the idea even that you are talking about me in this way, or that you feel this way about me, or that I bring you this great amount of pain because of my sexuality. That was my inner dialogue conversation about my family's reaction.
I think as a person who is also queer, and just knowing other queer people who've experienced this, the adults around us, the people around us, don't realize how much their words really impact the ability to come out and feel safe doing so. I even have family members now that I hear horrible things come out of their mouths about gay people, queer people, trans people. Actually, even teachers, I mean, you're a teacher as well, so maybe you've experienced this too, where people's beliefs about Because in Taiwan, just to give some backstory, Taiwan's the first country in Asia to legalize same-sex marriage. And before this happened, there was a lot of conversations about what that means for people, especially people living in Taiwan, people who are Taiwanese. So even from teachers, I would hear their homophobia, and I would see how they interact with that, even with children. For example, making jokes about, like, if it's like, for example, a boy, oh, your girlfriend, this or that, making an assumption that the only way to be in a relationship is in a heterosexual relationship. Or I had heard one teacher say, I don't even know why this came up. I think maybe the little boy was talking in Chinese, so I don't actually know what they were saying, but my co-teacher, so I have another Taiwanese teacher with me, whoops around and says, boys don't kiss boys, and then turns back around again. And I just heard them just like, what? Like, where did that even come from? I don't know, but it just hurt me to hear this kid who's not even like 8 years old being told that boys don't kiss boys. And already setting that repression, setting that fear that maybe, you know, one day he has that curiosity and he remembers that teacher telling him that.
Yeah, I completely understand.
So is there anything else that is important to highlight about your teenage years before we move on to some other parts of your story?
Well, in terms of like sexual identity and stuff, another thing that was difficult or like contributed to my journey with my sexual orientation and identity was my relationship with self-harm. And that was also tied into my mental health at the time. I started self-harming when I was 15, 16, and it took on different forms. It varied in like intensity, like there were times where it was really bad and I was doing it more frequently. And then it just like, there were phases of it. So it wasn't like gradually increasing and getting worse. It was like, sometimes it was really bad. And then sometimes I wasn't doing it at all. And then I would like relapse kind of thing. But that whole period of time, it was like basically from 15 and 16 to I was 20, like 2014.
So 4 years on and off of self-harm.
Yeah.
And what were the reasons for self-harming at the time?
Basically always a coping mechanism. And a lot of people, like I had a friend who was also self-harming at the time. And we had very different expressions of why we were doing things. And that was also part of the reason why I think like mine never got super, it was never life-threatening, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It was always like, I feel a certain amount of emotional pain and I don't know, I couldn't feel it necessarily. It's just like, I had this kind of sensation of like, this, but it's just like, it hurts so much that I'm numb kind of thing. And then the only way to kind of feel something tangible in order to start working through it was to make myself feel a degree of physical pain.
I see. So it was a way to, in some way, give yourself a release, like that emotional pain is being, 100%. It's like so intense that it's numb that you can't feel it. So it like, I'm imagining just kind of like a valve that you open and close so that you can let that energy out in a different kind of way. Okay.
Yeah.
So you were going through a lot of pain at that time, and who did you have to talk to about it?
I had a good support network in terms of my friends. I spoke to my family, but kind of like, it was very like fragmented. And it's just like, there was never, like, I remember there never being like one person who I could necessarily tell everything to. It was very like, okay, I'm going to go to this person for this specific issue and situation, but I wouldn't necessarily tell one person everything. I also, like in high school, we had counseling services that I made use of, not necessarily by choice, but I did make use of them eventually, but mostly my friends in high school. Like I had a good group of people around me. University, I was a little bit more like proactive about it. just because I knew how, like, my pain overtook me in high school. It's just like, I don't want something to have control over me to that extent again. So I sought out more proactive. So I went to like therapy when I didn't need therapy. In my opinion, everybody always needs therapy.
Yeah.
But I needed to understand myself a little bit better. Yeah.
So it was maybe more towards your early or late teens, early 20s that you started to really do a lot of self-exploration.
Yeah. University, I would say. Like high school, I was still very, very repressed. I think the first time that I admitted to myself, even in terms of like my straight passing relationships, not relationships, but interactions with people, it was still very repressed up until like university. So like 18, 19, but mostly it was like everything kind of happened at once. It was like my second year of university, I was 19 turning 20. And in that year, it was basically just like everything. Because I had a very like, not dysfunctional, but like naive, just because of like how I was raised to view relationships. I had a very naive understanding of what a relationship was supposed to be and how to form relationships. Another fun part about borderline personality disorder is our inability or like dysfunction when forming interpersonal relationships. Like there's this, if you think about the waves that I talked about earlier, you have this, when it comes to forming relationships with people, there are these waves as well. So like this intensity at first, and then like this almost like idealization of a person, and then it switches, and then you completely just like, especially in university, when you're meeting new people and going through this like this natural newness, it's like I would make really fast and intense connections with people, and then within like a month, just kind of a month or a couple of months, just like have completely like detached and moved on from that person, and not in a healthy way necessarily. It's just like I would like push to destroy that connection, if that made sense. Mm-hmm. And then like detach myself, because when it came to romantic relationships, straight or otherwise, I had no frame of reference really in terms of like the actual formation of a healthy relationship. It was always like these fantastical ideas and like people telling me, oh, this is how it's supposed to happen. But when you're constantly being told like, oh, like, no, you're not allowed to date. Like, I wasn't allowed to date or have relationships in high school. It was like a rule.
From your family.
Constantly being told, like, yeah. So if you're constantly being told in your high school years, that's like a very like formative time of like how you view relationships and your sexuality and that kind of thing. But like if you're constantly being told like this is not for this time of your life, that's going to come later, then it's just like I got to university and I was just like, okay, now where is it? Like you told me to wait all this time, I'm ready, where is it? Give it to me now. So it's just like I treated like every new person is like, oh, this is the thing that I've been waiting for. And then it would be like intensive, explosive thing that I put all of my energy into. And then it obviously wouldn't work out. And then I just like catch and move on. And then it was a very unhealthy cycle for a very long time.
So it sounds like in your family's culture, so like the dynamic of your family, there were a lot of rules around what to expect and when that really skewed and disrupted the way you understood relationships. And you mentioned before that maybe there was a religious aspect to maybe why your family viewed it that way. Can you tell me more about your family's culture and like where these things had come from?
Yeah. The things that they said weren't unreasonable or like necessarily overbearing. If you take the combination of like what they were saying and how they implemented their rules or expectations for their children, combined with my specific mental health situation, the fact that I was actually a queer person, even though I didn't realize it at the time, like all of those things compounded, led to me kind of internalizing this negative view of relationships or dysfunctional view of relationships. So my family is Christian. My mom was raised Catholic, and then when she married, my dad was no longer Catholic. My dad was raised Methodist, but my experience of them as Christians was like kind of more like the non-denominational, like definitely there was an element of like traditionalism and like from my mom's side, a little bit of the remnants of Catholicism, which are very like almost ritualistic in a sense. And there are definitely remnants of that that influenced their view of Christianity and also their parenting. But like certain rules, for example, were like for my sister and I, like no sleepovers, no date, no relationships while we were children, like legally children. After we were 18, it was just like, you can do whatever you want, you're adults. But it's just like, at least the way that I internalized it, it was like, if you're going to control so much up until the point of 18, and then all of a sudden you're like, okay, free bird, 18. And it's just like, what am I supposed to do?
There's not like a lot of modeling, and it's a good time, especially if we have that parental guidance. I know I didn't have that, but to experiment with what it's like to have relationships and have someone to get feedback with, or just to like talk about it and kind of learn how to navigate it in a healthy way and get advice and just basically those life lessons that we in some ways have to learn on our own, but especially when we're younger, just really helps to have someone support you through it. It really does help a lot as we're older, instead of just being like, okay, there you go. Here you are. You're supposed to be an expert now that you're 18, even though there's no learned skills for how to go about that. So yeah, that makes sense that that was really difficult for you, especially given the other, like you said, it's like a combination of not being given the opportunity to learn it and also the mental health challenges that were already taking place. That sounds like maybe, actually, I don't know. Did your family know that you're going through self-harm issues, or were you good at hiding it?
I was very good at hiding it in, I think when I started doing it, it wasn't as a coping mechanism. I was just kind of experimenting. But I remember like very early on in doing that, like I think my mom saw or somebody saw, and they reacted very negatively to it. And then I just got very good at hiding it. And then there was a point where I was more honest about it, especially in university. I was more honest with what I was going through, especially when it was getting really bad. Because at the time I was getting like free therapy from like campus health through my university, but I wanted to see a therapist outside of like what my campus could provide. Mm-hmm. I had to be honest with them about why I needed therapy. So they knew, but towards the end of it.
And going back to when you first started going to university and you're building relationships with people, you mentioned pretty quickly you would burn that bridge and try to cut it off. And I wonder, how did that affect your sexual relationships if you were having sex at that time?
So I only started having sex later, like I think it was my third year of university. So there weren't like a ton of sexual experiences, thankfully. I say thankfully just because like I think that I probably would have handled them very negatively, thinking of the space that I was in at the time. Even before like actual sex, just like any kind of like romantic relationship was very difficult, just because I was placing a lot of energy in them and expecting a lot from those experiences, and instead of just trying to focus on like learning about, you know, myself and what I like. It was very performative in a lot of ways at first, until I took the steps to kind of know who I was and know what I wanted in a romantic and sexual relationship.
What do you mean by performative?
It was just like I had an understanding of what it was supposed to be, and that played into kind of like role. And it was just like, you know, like acting the way I thought I was supposed to act when it came to romantic and sexual relationships. So that's what I mean by performative.
Okay.
Yeah. So in terms of sex, it was kind of like the shift came where it was just like, oh, I know I want this now. If that makes sense. The person that I first had sex with, thankfully, it wasn't a situation where it was like I made this intense connection. I mean, it kind of happened like that, but we were like friends for a long time. But I know that like the way that I kind of like cut ties, still very like, just like, okay, we've done this thing now. And then things happened and I completely just like, I didn't spend any time trying to repair. That's kind of like how I treat situations. It's just like, as soon as there's a conflict, I will just like run. Just like, okay, bye. Like you've done this thing, I'm gonna go now. That's how that usually manifests. Other sexual relationships were more casual. So it wasn't so much influenced by that kind of wave just because they were too casual or like too short-lived to be caught in that cycle. Like I wasn't making connections with some of the people that I was having sex with at the time. There was one particularly, not bad, but like particularly intense relationship or situationship that I had where it was exactly what I described earlier, like someone who I met and then like within like a couple of months. And then that was the first time where like one of those typical relationships, those fast conception kind of relationships where I had a sexual relationship with that person. And that was really hard because it just made the descent a lot more destructive, if that makes sense. Just because like I had this idea of like, I'm in love with this person and like now we've had sex and now like all these other things. And I put so much into that relationship with that person that like when everything ultimately descended into chaos, it was very, very hard for me. Yeah, so like that all happened within 6 months of like becoming friends, having like this romantic slash sexual relationship. And then like, the thing that I do is like, once I'm not in a relationship, but like, I will push people basically until it's just like, let's see how much you can handle. And then inevitably they can't handle something. And then the relationship crumbles. And then that once it's crumbled, then I devalue. So it's just like, then I change my opinion of them and I have to like demonize a person in order to get rid of them from my life.
And that sounds all really painful. And in my body, I'm imagining just how much like anxiety and like maybe even self-hatred that comes from that.
Oh yeah, it was a ton of that.
That maybe that comes from a place of fear or a worry that there's something maybe about you that is not lovable and you want to maybe test people or just to see, you know, how much, like you said, they can handle in some way to maybe prove to yourself that you're not lovable when they do eventually leave.
Yeah, it was definitely just because also like when I pushed people, it was never a situation that would occur naturally kind of thing. The things that I did or said or the situations that I found myself in, they weren't characteristic of me. They weren't because I was this person. It was just like, it was situations that I was creating in order to push them. And I used that as like a validation, like you said, like the confirmation that I am not worthy of their love or of love in general. And it was definitely like when I started getting therapy specifically for borderline, like that helped a lot because I could recognize my own cycles and patterns and things that I was doing. And it's just like, but this is not like who you are. Like you're not friends with a person based on this thing and now they're getting sick of you kind of thing. Like that was a big theme. It's just like, oh, this person is going to, like they're going to see through not even my facade, but like it's just like they're going to get bored of you or they're going to lose interest. That was always the narrative. So it's just like pushing them to get to that point sooner kind of thing, even though there was no guarantee, like, I don't understand necessarily, I suppose this is why it's an actual disorder. It's just like, I can never understand why I thought that they were going to get bored. But it's just like, there was always the thing that's just like, oh, they're going to get bored and they're going to leave kind of thing. So it's just kind of, why not make them leave so that it was on my timeline, basically.
Yeah.
And that also came from a place of like, I knew what I was doing when I formed those relationships. I'm a very good manipulator. And I found that I just, because like I've been in multiple situations where people can't believe that they've only been friends with me for like maybe like a month or a couple of months because of like how close we've become. And I'm just like, yeah, I know. It's because like, I know that I have the ability to make people feel safe and feel close enough to me that they will share things about their life that they wouldn't necessarily tell people that they've only known for like a week or two. And then like we've become really close. I think like within myself, because I know the nature of how I formed this relationship and like how fast everything has happened, it's like the universe maintaining balance almost. It's just like you create this thing so quickly and so intensely and it's going to go out the same way. It's not all of my relationships. Because like I have solid friendships. I've been in functional dating relationships before. But it's like for the relationships that have come about intensely like that, they always end that way, which I find interesting. It's very difficult for me to have an intense relationship, like for that intense conception to take place and not to have it end that way.
And that makes sense. When you were saying that, I was thinking of like the balance of creation and chaos, so how there has to be some sort of equilibrium.
Yeah.
And I wonder, since you've been able to self-reflect and do that work and understanding your patterns, how has that helped to create a different kind of balance now in your relationships?
Well, just being like self-aware, like I can kind of take a step back and kind of like assess why. So like if I have this kind of urge for closeness with a person where like it's almost like obsessive, it's just like why? And kind of just being not letting myself be completely taken up by the process of my mind, so that I don't get caught up in those things, which I think is like, if I look at like my stable relationships now, especially the relationships or friendships that I've formed since university and since being in Taiwan, especially, is definitely this concerted effort that I've put into like how I've formed these relationships so that I don't make the same mistakes again. Kind of thing.
Yeah.
My relationships and friendships definitely look different.
You mentioned this before and I didn't have a chance to say, but you were talking about like one of your first like authentic relationships that ended up ending in that chaotic way. But you mentioned it was with a woman, and I smiled because I was happy to hear that it was with a woman. But for you, I'm curious, what was that like as you're coming to terms with your queerness to date a woman?
Like, okay, so firstly, it was a situation, not a relationship. I've never actually been in a typical like relationship, like had a girlfriend or had a boyfriend. I've dated, I'm doing that more now, but like at the time I was very much in a state of just like friends and then like having sex with friends. But she was my first sexual experience with a woman. Yeah, like sex. That was the first time. So that also contributed to kind of like idealization of her. I was like, I'm going to marry you. Like, it was very intense. But I appreciated a lot of things about her and about that experience just because like I don't remember ever feeling repressed or like I needed to hide anything about how I felt about her or what I wanted with her. She was the first woman that I had feelings for unashamedly.
Even though there were still issues related to like that fear of rejection, it was a huge step for your coming to terms with your queer identity and being able to accept yourself. Wow, that's awesome. As you continue to get older and connect with yourself and who you are, How did just continuing to work on yourself and to heal from past fears of being queer?
I focused a lot on like my self-worth and my relationship with myself, because that's where the issue was rooted. It was just like this idea that like being queer, being bisexual was like deviant. Like that's what I had internalized. And basically changing the relationship that I needed to change the relationship that I had with myself before I could go forward with relationships or anything basically with other people, with the expectation that they would be functional and positive experiences. I'm not afraid to fail in relationships, if that makes sense. Whereas before there was like this this fear that like, oh, I'm gonna mess up. And because I mess up, this person is going to leave. Like there's no narrative like that now. Like there's definitely still fear and the remnants of those old processes. But I would say that I've, just because of how much I've intentionally practiced rewiring my mind in terms of like how I view myself in relationships, that almost like my reflexive thinking has changed around that. So it's not immediately me just kind of blaming myself, because I'm no longer seeking this kind of validation that I'm worthy of love within a relationship. Like I get that from myself.
Yeah.
You know, that obviously takes a huge, like it lifts the burden of that from any kind of relationship that I hope to pursue.
Thank you for sharing that. And so I guess there are a couple of things I wanted to also check in with, because you mentioned when we were talking about different things going on for you to mention the podcast was body dysmorphia. And so I wonder if you still want to talk about that, or how does that interact with everything we've been talking about?
It also ties into heavily this thing of self-worth and just kind of like the way that I viewed myself just in life and also in relationships. Like I thought that I was like, I basically refer to myself as like a monster. And then in terms of like the actual body dysmorphia part of it, it's just like, I struggled a lot with eating and eating disorders. I was raised in a household where it was like, in terms of like, for example, like the self-harm and stuff went undetected just because that was easy to hide. My difficult relationship with like food and eating and like diet, that kind of stuff, was very difficult to hide just because like my family and food is so interconnected. So like I had experiences where just like I did not eat, and like my mother would know that I was not eating. I was in her physical house and she knew everything in terms of like the food that passed down out. It's like she knew everything. So it's just like if we weren't eating, she would know about it. So like if I had been in a family situation or a home life where that wasn't a big deal, I probably could have developed like an actual, if we're looking at specific eating disorders, I probably would have developed like anorexia or something if my mother had not literally force-fed me at times. So like the body dysmorphia and the eating disorders kind of like go hand in hand, just because like I viewed myself as like, it's very weird to describe, but it's just like I've always thought that I am bigger than I am. And that started like as early as like primary school, like this kind of view that I was bigger, like significantly bigger than I actually physically am.
And when you talk about bigger, you mean like actual physical space.
Yeah. And it's not even, it's very strange because it's just like, it's not even like, I say bigger and not like, I don't use the word like fat, just because like it's not, that doesn't encompass what I'm trying to say when I say like, it's just like, it feels almost like bull in a china shop kind of situation.
Hmm.
Like, I just feel like I am, it's not clumsy is the wrong word. It's just like,
the words, or like the way I'm imagining it, and correct me if I'm not on the right
track or understanding with it, but maybe even just early on feeling like you were too much or too burdensome, or that your energy, your personality was just bigger than what other people expected of you in a way. And so maybe
that was definitely part of it, but it was definitely also just like a physical
part to it too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I remember in like primary school, I was like picked on for being chubby, and I think I internalized that, and then it was like big, like cartoonishly big. Do you know what the Michelin man is?
Yeah.
That's okay. How I would feel. It was like everything was just like, there's my body, but then there was like a layer around it that I was like encased in like this biggishness.
I wonder, was there a feeling of being trapped in that encasement?
Yeah, definitely. And then just my poor relationship with food and diet and that kind of stuff came from a place of like wanting to almost like starve that part of myself. So it's like, imagine feeling you're trapped in like this balloonish outer shell, and then to cope with it, you don't eat because you're trying to starve that outer shell, but because there is no actual outer shell, you're just starving yourself. Now it's kind of like, I still have a very interesting relationship with eating, but it's more like I'm very controlled and I have to be very disciplined, because it can kind of go either way. Either I don't eat enough or I overeat, kind of thing. So I have to be very disciplined about it. It's not for the same reason. Right now I'm intermittent fasting, and that kind of helps with like this balance of like, it makes me feel like I'm not overeating and not undereating or eating too little, kind of thing.
Okay.
It's a system that kind of working for me at the moment.
And were there any ways that body dysmorphia or the way you viewed yourself affect your sexual relationships or how you felt while having sex? Because as you mentioned before, the word performative, sex can feel like a very performative act when we're really focused on ourselves and like how we're doing, what we're doing, what we look like while we're doing it. And so I wonder for you what that might have looked like.
Like I mentioned before, like I only started having sex like towards the end of my time at university, and a lot of that was because like the mental stuff, but then also like physically I just was not comfortable with my body to be intimate with someone in that way. So like in terms of like the body dysmorphia and stuff, also like the self-harm and stuff, that really played into just me not wanting to have sex, just because like I had literal signs on my body that people could see that would be like, whoa, okay. So it definitely affected my sexual confidence. And then once I resolved things, I was in a place where like I felt comfortable sharing my body with other people and letting them in to those spaces.
So while you're going through the mental health things with the self-harm and the disordered eating, that took sex off the table for you because you didn't want people to physically see the consequences of the self-harm, and you were uncomfortable with your body that you just did not want people looking at you.
Yeah. I was at a point where like I didn't want to be around myself. So it was just like there was no way that was going to happen
with other people.
Yeah. So until that was all resolved, like, because I'm a very, like in terms of like love languages and that kind of thing, like physical affection is one of mine, but that for me that manifests in like, I am very selective about who I let near me physically. So in terms of how that manifested for sex, it was just like, I trust no one, therefore I will have sex with no one.
So what does that look like now for you after you've done the work to heal and know yourself better and know, you know, what you need and what is helpful for you to step away from the patterns of your past?
It's been fun, for one thing. Just because, like, now, like, I'm just more sexually open, more sexually confident. I remember having a conversation with a friend that I made here, speaking about like how open I am sexually, or just like how easy it is to talk to me about sex and things like that. And it's just like, it's weird because if this person had known me a few years ago, it would have been like, it's a completely different person. So it's just like my attitude towards myself and towards sex completely changed. And that obviously allowed me to have certain experiences that I would never have even thought possible when I was in that space. So, I mean, like now I have a very healthy relationship with myself and a healthy relationship with sex. And I also enjoy that I am a lot more educated about sex. Like, not just, that's the thing, like as you become more aware of yourself sexually, like you have a responsibility to educate yourself and to know potentially what's going on with the body of your sexual partner or partners. So it's just like going through that process of learning as well, like actual technical knowledge, has been very interesting and liberating.
Where did you get your education? Like how did you access that information for yourself?
Reading a lot of books, speaking to people who have had different experiences, older people, people with different sexual orientations. Being a more active member of LGBT plus community has really helped. So like, for example, like learning more about what it means to be transgender and how that influences sexual relationships and what they have to go through and how it's different for different transgender people. One of my best friends is transgender. And when I first started hanging out with her, it was like I was watching, I don't think she was out as transgender at the time, but Ash Hardell. I was watching her on YouTube.
Ash Hardell, yeah.
I think we spoke about that, or you mentioned her when we first met.
Yeah, but I think like, I was actually wearing Ash Hardell's shirt. It's like, this is my LGBT.
Yeah. No, I love all of Ash's stuff. And I've watched her stuff for a long time. So like just going on that process of learning with other people we're going through their own things. Yeah, so like I research a lot based on like certain experiences. So if I have a certain experience and I have questions, then I will either ask them about it or like do a deep dive on Google.
Yeah, I think it used to be a problem when especially teenagers accessed information online instead of being able to talk to their parents, but and I guess I used to have an opinion about that. That was just like, oh, you know, people have to be careful. And that's still true. But nowadays,
there are a lot
valuable,
more resources. Yeah.
And they're so good that it's probably better to go to the YouTube resources than to your own parents. Because realistically, our parents, I mean, if they're not actively already talking to us about sex, it's probably because they don't have the words or the language or the education themselves either. So... No, I think people want to encourage parents to talk about it, but if they don't know it themselves, then honestly, there's no point. or at least it's just not going to be the helpful thing that we all hope it would be. So yes, to all of the ways that you're able to educate yourself, because I think that is just really good, especially coming into a community like the LGBT community, who has so many like people who are educated themselves and have very important voices within the community to help others. It's just a really great place to understand yourself more and your sexual energy and your sexualness. I keep wanting to say sexuality, but I think that gets confused with orientation, but that sexual part of us. Yeah. And so thinking about yourself now and what you hope for the future, what do you hope in terms of sex and relationships to achieve?
I hope to keep learning more about myself and what I enjoy sexually and also how to better pleasure others. The thing that I enjoy most about sex in like a educational sort of way is like learning a new form of communication with someone. Like, it's not just like, there's obviously the verbal aspect of it, which is also, for me, it's been great in terms of like learning to speak up for myself. But I mean, like, sex as a language between two people and becoming better versed in somebody else's sexual language about themselves. Is, like, that's my hope, that I would be better in tuned or better able to understand somebody else's sexual language, basically.
I like that you said that, because I think we all have a different language and there's no really one way to communicate with someone, especially when it comes to sex. And like, I know they describe different love languages, but even amongst the like different love languages, we just have our own ways. And it can be fun to like learn that. I mean, especially just to learn someone else, learn someone else's body, and get to know their needs and their wants. It can be a really fun adventure with another person, whether it's a sexual relationship or even just a friendship. But it is, it does take work and time, but it is a fun way to communicate. Especially, I mean, there are different reasons why it can be hard for us to verbalize what we want or to verbalize what we're going through. So being able to connect in that way as well is really helpful, because talking isn't always the best thing for everyone for certain things. So yeah. And what else is important for us to talk about in terms of maybe things that maybe we missed about your story or what you're looking for in the future or now?
A big part of my story comes, it all comes around to basically the relationship with yourself. Those relationships are only functional when your relationship with yourself is like the number one priority in terms of like maintaining a healthy relationship with yourself and knowing yourself. Something that was also like just from the nature of being repressed, it's just like your relationship with yourself sexually, in terms of like having sex with yourself, masturbation, things like that, like learning about your body and taking that into when you do have sex with other people, that component, especially for women, I feel like masturbation is a lot less commonplace or talked about, at least. It plays a big part into like your sexual confidence and understanding of yourself and understanding of what you want from sex. So like for me, going on that journey with myself was also a very big part of me becoming like sexually confident and establishing a better relationship with myself.
Thank you, Jillian, for being on the show. I really appreciated
it. Pleasure.
And
I really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, thank you. And is there any just ways to contact you if you would like for people to reach you?
I have my Instagram, which is JillianNathalie27, Jillian with a J. And then I also have a blog where I post my art and my writing. And that is, it's linked on my Instagram, I think, cutthroatsweetheart.com.
And I will leave that also on the show notes for people to access. Thank you. Bye.
If you loved and appreciated the show or hated it, okay, please share your thoughts on whatever platform you're listening on. I'd love to hear your feedback so that I can continue to improve the show. I would also love if you showed support to our guest, Jillian. I will leave her information in the show notes so you can check out her Instagram and her website that she referenced. And so I am going to go. Everyone, take care, and I will see you next week. Every Saturday, come find a new episode of Sex And. See you later. Bye.